You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Great War, Episode 93. This week, I would like to thank all of the podcast Patreon supporters who have chosen to support the show over on patreon.com/historyofthegreatwar, where you can also go to throw out a question or topic to be answered on episode 100, which is coming up in just about 2 months, I guess. This is episode 5 of our story of the Battle of the Somme. Last week saw the beginning of the attack, and we also looked at the ill-fated attack of the British 7th Corps in their diversionary role to the north of the main effort of the 4th Army. This episode we will continue to work our way south as we discuss the attacks of the 8th and 10th Corps of the 4th Army. These attacks against very strong German positions around Thiepval and Beaumont-Hamel would be quite disappointing, and the reasons for that disappointment will probably seem familiar to longtime listeners. The attack of the 8th Corps represented the far northern end of the main attack, and the Corps had been entrusted to the care of General Hunter Weston, who we met at Gallipoli about a year ago now. This was to be his first action in command of the troops on the Western Front, and under his command he would be launching 3 divisions into the attack. The first and furthest north was the 31st Division, which was one of the units made up primarily of Powell's battalions that we talked about a couple of episodes ago. For the most part, these battalions had been raised in northern England, and while morale and confidence could not have been higher, their skills and experience left something to be desired. The other 2 divisions were the 29th and the 4th, both of which were regular divisions, or at least they had been regular divisions earlier in the war. The 29th at this point had the nickname of the Immortal after being heavily involved in Gallipoli, and then they spent 6 months since their evacuation in January 1916, rebuilding and retraining in preparation for their next attack. The 4th Division had been in France since the beginning, and had their numbers replenished several times over, as successive sets of replacements slowly wasted away on the Western Front. The plan for these divisions had been had them moving against Hawthorne Ridge and the villages of Serre and Beaumont-Hamel. This area was almost perfect for the defense because it was made up of a series of ridges and valleys that had been heavily fortified by the Germans. The 31st Division was assigned the task of moving forward and taking the village of Serre, and in the process of that, they would pivot to the north, and this would provide a northern anchor upon which the entirety of the British front would be based. The 4th and 29th Divisions were then given the task of advancing directly towards Hawthorne Ridge and Beaumont-Hamel. This was problematic, because during most of the advance they would be in a valley that was almost entirely overlooked by the German defenses. Once they advanced through it, they would then have to contend with the German second line on the Beaucourt Spur. Advancing up this valley was dangerous, but the hope was that the creeping barrage would protect them, as it was supposed to on other areas of the front. This would keep the Germans' heads down as long as possible, until the British were right on top of them. However, the divisional commanders wanted to quicken the speed that the artillery would advance, concerned that it was going to advance slower than the infantry could go, and the troops would be held back by it. Because of this, they increased the speed of the advance from 50 yards a minute to 100 yards a minute. And they also changed it so that instead of starting in between the lines, it would actually start right on top of the German positions. This meant that not only would the artillery be quickly running away from the infantry, but it would also have one hell of a head start. On the 29th Division's front, they also had the largest mine that would be used on July the 1st, positioned under the Hawthorne Redoubt. This redoubt was in front of Beaumont Hamel, and there was quite a bit of debate about the best use of this mine, which consisted of 40,000 pounds of explosives, which is more than a few. Hunter Weston wanted to set off the mine at 3:30 a.m., well before the main assault, with the goal of seizing the redoubt before any other troops went forward. The inspector of mines, on the other hand, who was also sort of the expert on the mines and what would happen after they exploded, advised the British commanders that exploding it so early was not the correct move. His concern was based on what had happened in previous usage of British mines. In these instances, when the British had tried to capture the mine-induced the crater that the mine produced, they had almost always lost. The Germans were generally just faster and better at capturing these craters, or at least keeping the British from capturing them. If this trend held, then a failure to capture the crater would also completely waste all of the work that had went into the mine, which had been months now of preparation. Because of this, he advised simply exploding it right at the beginning of the attack, instead of making it a separate action. He just wanted it involved in the general attack. This would hopefully maximize British strengths, which was the number of men going forward. After a lot of discussion, it was decided to explode the mine 10 minutes before the attack, at 7:20 a.m. In hindsight, while this seems like a reasonable compromise, it really had the same effect as doing it at 3:30. The troops assigned to attack the crater had to do so without the benefit of other troops on either side, and if they failed, it would be a serious problem. Only two platoons were assigned to capture the crater, which was supposed to be enough. But as with everything else for the British that was supposed to be enough, it would not be. The mine explosion would also be a big sign, a big glaring sign, to the Germans that things were about to happen. And it was also a sign for the British artillery to move their fire onto the next set of German trenches, or at least the heavy artillery, leaving only the smaller guns to assist the infantry attack. On the German side, they considered the area around Saire to be critical to their defense, and it was one of the handful of really critical strong points that they had spent most of the last year making into a position that was as strong as possible. The entrenchments in this area were perfectly placed to repel the types of attacks that would be coming at them, and the fact that the heavy artillery would be lifted off 10 minutes before the attack started, and even the light artillery would be off the Germans by the time the infantry arrived, just made everything better. When the fire lifted, they quickly rushed out of their shelters, which had kept them safe, and moved into the line. They were easily able to man their positions and see that most of the wire was still intact. There were a few areas that had been damaged, but that was definitely the exception in this case. They also had time to move up some extra ammunition and shift infantry positioning based on what little damage had been done by the artillery so far. When the British troops came into view, the Germans were definitely ready. We will start today with the 31st Division, and on their front, the attack was simply a disaster. The first wave went over the top and immediately ran into a solid wall of German fire. Here is Private Reginald Glenn, who was in the second wave. Quote, "The first line all lay down, and I thought they'd had different orders because we'd all been told to walk. It appears that they lay down because they'd been shot and either killed or wounded. They were just mown down like corn. Our line simply went forward and the same thing happened. You were just trying to find your way in amongst the shell holes. You can imagine walking through a shell-pitted ground with holes all over the place trying to walk like that. You couldn't even see where you were walking. When you got to the line, you saw that a lot of the first line were stuck on the wire, trying to get through. We didn't get to the German wire. I didn't get as far as our wire. Nobody did, except just a few odd ones who got through and got as far as the German wire. The machine gun fire was all trained on our wire. Only a few crept along. I lay down. We weren't getting any orders at all. There was nobody to give any orders. because the officers were shot down. End quote. There were a few British soldiers who managed to get across in a few scattered areas, usually in those few lucky areas where the wire had been cut. Any British soldiers who did manage to get across were quickly surrounded by German counterattacks, and much like we discussed last week, they were either pushed out of the trenches or killed, since no help was able to reach them. It was a rough day for the 31st Division, and in total about two-thirds of the men that they had sent forward would not make it through the attack. To the south of the 31st, the 4th Division moved forward, and it had the most success of any of the three 8th Corps divisions. They were still facing prepared German positions, who were able to slowly traverse their machine guns over the advancing British units, and they were also having problems with fire hitting them from the Red End Ridge behind the 1st German line. But in this area, some of the British used a tactic that was not executed by other units. This tactic was to dig shallow tunnels out into no man's land. And then right as the attack started, the end of these tunnels were opened up, and Lewis guns were positioned to fire on the German positions at close range. We have seen this tactic used on the Russian front as well. Unfortunately, this tactic, while it did help, did not prove to be the silver bullet that it was hoped to be. Since the infantry to the left and the right of these Lewis guns were having so many problems, the guns had very little protection, and this meant that the German infantry were able to focus on the guns and knock them out, before sending small parties of men out to take over the tunnel openings and to close them, which prevented the British from executing any other tunnel-based shenanigans. It was a good idea, though, and it could have proved very beneficial if other things had went a bit better. While some of the 4th Divisions were stopped before the 1st German trench, some did manage to take these first positions. Here is Lieutenant William Collier, who commanded one of these units. Quote, "I must go on. That's right. I have that firmly fixed in my mind. I can do no good by stopping here, and the idea of going back could not be entertained for a single moment. But it's rather vague. Where am I to go? What am I going to do when I get there? I certainly never anticipated the extraordinary situation I found myself in now. I have lost touch with half my men in this cursed network of trenches, and in trying to get a hold of them again, I've lost the other half. The whole attack, as far as we are concerned, seems to be completely messed up. Well, if I can't find my own men, I must jolly well collect some others and go forward with them. Let's have a look over the top and try to see what's happening. I climb onto the fire step and look over the parapet. The same scene is there, a desolate waste being churned up by machine guns and shell fire, shells bursting unpleasantly close as well." End quote. It actually looked like, for a few hours, that the British units might be able to hold on to some of the first set of German positions, but the failures of the other divisions made it difficult, or really just impossible. While they held on long after the units of the 31st and the 29th were pushed back to their start lines, and attempts were made to try and get them reinforcements and supplies, it just was not possible. And in what was becoming a sort of sounding like a broken record, the small units of the 4th Division were eventually pushed back to their start lines. On the 29th Division's front, the crater that had been created devastated the German units nearby, but those further away were completely safe in their shelters. Here is an officer of the German 119th Reserve Regiment, who was in the trenches nearby, but far enough away to be safe from the explosion. Quote, "The ground all around was white with the debris of chalk, as if it had been snowing. A giant crater 50 yards in diameter and some 60 feet deep gaped like an open wound on the side of the hill. This explosion was a signal for the infantry to attack, and everyone got ready and stood on the lower steps of the dugouts, rifles in hand, waiting for the bombardment to lift. In a few minutes, the shelling ceased, and we rushed up the steps and out onto the crater positions. Ahead of us, wave after wave of British troops were crawling out of their trenches and coming forward towards us at a walk. Their bayonets were glistening in the sun." End quote. The British soldiers who directly attacked the crater found themselves in a difficult position. They got to their side of the crater just fine, but were faced with the fact that the Germans had already positioned themselves on the other side. This meant that they were in the unenviable position of having to try and attack through the crater, which was basically impossible, given how wide and deep it was. They were not assisted by the main attack on either side either, since those attacks had the least success of any attacks on the 8th Corps front. Within minutes, almost all of the British were pinned down, well short of the German lines. This problem was compounded when there were reports of great success in the area, and more troops were sent forward on the right, in the belief that the German lines had already been taken. These troops simply found themselves in the same position, either pinned down in no man's land or killed.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The results of the attack by the 8th Corps was disappointing. Not only had the British failed to make any meaningful gains during these attacks, they had also lost thousands of men. The 31st Division suffered 3,600 casualties, the 4th, 5,700, and the 29th, 5,200. In the 31st, the PALS battalions had been hit hard when they were committed due to their inexperience. In the 29th, the unit suffered casualties for sort of the opposite reason. The desire to live up to lofty expectations of previous campaigns pushed men forward when they had no business attempting another attack. In the end, experience didn't matter against the German fire. In total, there were 14,000 casualties for the 8th Corps, 50% of its nominal strength. What was even worse, and what would have trickle-down effects on the entire front, was that the attacks failed so quickly. The cascading effect would allow the German artillery and machine guns on the southern end of the 8th Corps front to turn their guns to the south to assist in defending against the attacks of the 10th Corps, which was having its own special set of difficulties, and they certainly did not need their task to be any more difficult. The 10th Corps was stationed immediately to the south of the 8th Corps, and they would be sending forward the 36th and the 32nd Divisions, with the goal of capturing all of the Thiepval Plateau. The goal was to take all of it in one go, and then to consolidate their positions on the other side. It was absolutely critical that both divisions succeeded simultaneously, though, because if either of them failed, then the other would be hugely exposed to the other German positions. The problem was that the German positions were strong, especially in the area of the 32nd Division. This included the Leipzig Redoubt and the tip of the Thiepval Spur. This position had an excellent view of the surrounding countryside and immaculate fields of fire across no man's land to the front, to the left, and to the right. On its flanks, it was both then assisted by and it also assisted all the other German defenses in the area. On the main Thiepval Ridge was Thiepval Village, which had also been fortified by the Germans. The British thought that they had taken care of the village through the use of the artillery, since they had basically destroyed every building during the bombardment. Most of this had been accomplished quickly by the British guns, since the civilian buildings had little chance of withstanding a military-grade bombardment. However, the Germans had taken the time to expand and reinforce all of the underground cellars and basements in the village. The rubble that was then laid on top of them from the buildings did little harm to these positions, and maybe in some ways even helped them by providing extra cover for German infantry. Even under the best of conditions, these positions would have been a hard nut to crack, and these would not be the best conditions. Here, as in other places, the artillery would outpace the British infantry, leaving them to fight it out alone. The attack of the 32nd Division was helped by the fact that one of the brigades took the initiative, under the orders of their commander, to crawl out into no man's land before zero hour. These men were as close as they possibly could be without being hit by their own artillery. This position gave them a huge leg up on other British units, and because of that, they at least had some success. The other brigade did not follow this lead, though, and while they tried their best to storm the German positions on Thiepville Spur and the Leipzig Redoubt, the German machine guns proved to simply be too strong. They were fired on by guns from the ridge, from the spur, from the village, everywhere, making the attack all but impossible. There were areas that the Germans were pushed hard, though, and one of the units hit hard was the Reserve Infantry Regiment 99, which was positioned on Thiepville Ridge. This is where the men hit the hardest, the 97th Brigade that had crawled out into no man's land, and their preemptive move into no man's land made it all possible. But it was also here that the artillery had the most effect of anywhere on the 10th Corps front. This resulted in the 97th Brigade having the first German positions taken quickly. However, even the most successful units soon ran into issues, as even though they had got through the first German line, they now had to traverse 150 yards to get beyond it and onto the next one, and even more if they ever wanted to get to their final objective. While in many areas the first sets of German wire had been destroyed and the troops had managed to get past it, these new and intact belts that were between the lines now made for an almost insurmountable obstacle. As they tried to continue their push, they began to lose more and more men, which just made them more vulnerable when their counterattacks came later. Again, no reinforcements were able to get across to them. The units that had advanced the furthest had to make a choice. They could not stay where they were. The positions were just too vulnerable to German fire from the flanks, so they either had to go forward or they had to go back. And what was left of the 97th Brigade made another attempt to go forward. One more attempt. And here's Private Bentley Meadows to describe this attempt. Quote, "An officer suddenly jumped the parapet and shouted, 'Come on, the 17th. I followed him with about 20 others, but we found the barbed wire impossible to cut through, and he gave us the order, every man for himself.'" End quote. Thiepville Village was the key to the German position, and from there it was possible to fire rounds at the German attacks in all over the area, and all throughout the day the German machine guns in that village continued to fire, belt after belt, hour after hour, from dawn until late in the evening. The results were thousands of British casualties caused just by these specific machine guns, and the 21 machine guns inside the village fired over 200,000 rounds between them, and the infantry had also been heavily firing on the British, with the average expenditure of ammunition for each man at around 350 rounds of rifle ammunition. This stat becomes particularly impressive when you consider the fact that no German soldier carried this many rounds on them at any given time, so it probably took several resupplies to reach that number. That the Germans were in a position to distribute that much extra ammunition says something about how much they truly dominated the situation. The British leaders were once again not helped by false reports coming from the front that made the British gains seem far more impressive than they actually were. This included reports that the British were already in Thiepville Village, and that it was safely taken from the Germans. Because of this report, the artillery fire was pushed even further away from the struggling infantry just at a time when it needed it the most. Now that the British had been stopped, it was time for the Germans to begin launching counterattacks. After all, Germans gonna German, and that means they're gonna launch counterattacks. In the hardest hit areas, this was easier said than done, because of the number of German casualties. Let's go back to that 99th Reserve Infantry Regiment, where Lieutenant Castle describes his situation while trying to launch a counterattack on the British 97th Brigade. Quote, "Only a few men who are in the second trench are left. Volunteers begin to drive the intruders out, proceeding from the left, from breastwork to breastwork, throwing hand grenades, and slowly they succeed. Badly wounded Tommies fall into our hands, and their rations provide something to satisfy our hunger and thirst. And then we come to a part of the position where the enemy is able to stop our advance by flanking our machine gun fire. I return to my company and give orders to restore communication between the various positions and to rearrange the groups to take account of the casualties. End quote. Just like their fellow soldiers to the north, though, the 32nd would soon be pushed back off of their gains. This is Lieutenant Colonel Ambrose Ricardo of the 36th Ulster Division. Quote, I stood on the parapet between the two center exits to wish them luck. They got through without delay, no fuss, no shouting, no running, everything solid and thorough, just like the men themselves. Here and there, a boy would wave his hand to me as I shouted a good luck to them through my megaphone, and all had a cheery face. Most of them were carrying loads. Fancy advancing against heavy fire with a big roll of barbed wire on your shoulder. End quote. The attack by the Ulster Division was divided by the River Anger and its river valley. They were in for a hard fight against the German positions there, including the Schwaben Redoubt. Here is Private David Starrett of the Royal Irish Rifles, as he describes the actions of his commander, Colonel Crozier, after the attack had started. Quote, between the burst, Crozier doubled to the sunken road, his batman making a bad second in the race. The 10th Rifles are wiped out, he shouted. We reached our own men. They had taken what cover the place offered. Bernard had been killed. Crozier rallied what was left of the 10th. Sound the advance, he yelled. Sound, damn you, sound the advance. The bugler's lips were dry. He had been wounded. His lungs were shot. A second later, he fell dead at the colonel's feet. Hine cut the cord and gave the bugle to somebody who could play. Crozier was signaling the men on. He walked into bursts, he fell into holes, his clothing was torn by bullets, but he himself was all right. Moving about as if on the parade ground, he again and again rallied his men. Without him, not a man would have passed the Schwaben Redoubt, let alone reached the final objective. End quote. The Irish smashed into the German lines and actually managed to take the Schwaben Redoubt, a very strong German position. They attacked with such ferocity that in some of the German sectors, every man had been killed, wounded, or captured. However, such a feat could not escape the notice of the German troops to the north. When they saw that the redoubt was in British, or I guess Irish hands, although they didn't know that, they quickly contacted the divisional commander in the area. He made quick work of ordering in a counterattack to retake the position. The Germans in this area were disorganized, though. And even though they had the best of intentions, it was hard to get together the units necessary for the task. The units were sent for the attack to begin at noon, but it did not reach all of the units involved due to the fact that most of the telephone links had been destroyed during the earlier action. Even with these difficulties, though, there simply were not enough Irishmen to defend their gains, regardless of their bravery. Slowly, the Germans began to close in, and the Irish, being totally isolated by this point, began to give back more and more ground that they had already taken. Slowly, and through the use of plenty of bombs, the Irish were pushed further and further back. They continued to resist, even though they found themselves in the first German positions with only no man's land at their back. Most of the officers and NCOs were slowly killed or wounded, but the men held on, and they managed just barely to hold on to the first set of German trenches. Now, they would lose them a little over 48 hours later, but they had done what almost no other British units north of Fricourt had managed to do on July the 1st. They had made real gains, and they held them until July the 2nd. The 10th Corps had lost 10,000 casualties. Many of the wounded men found themselves trying to find their way back to get away from the front. Gunner William Grant describes his situation. Quote, each time we were coming back from the guns with empty ammunition wagons, we packed as many wounded as we could as we passed the dressing stations on our way back, but a lot of them were too badly wounded to stand the jolting of the wagon and preferred to go on their own. End quote. Reinforcements on the way to the front, like the West Yorkshire Regiment, found it difficult to even try to move forward. So many men were trying to find their way back, it was just impossible. While the men at the front had been fighting or dying, and the artillery had been following their orders, and the countless reinforcing units had been trying to find their way forward, in their dugouts all along the front, officers had to deal with the fact that the attacks had been a failure. Here is Sergeant Henry Coates, who is stationed near the southern end of the 10th Corps front, as he recalls what happens when he went back to the command dugout. Inside, he found his commander, a general, slumped in his chair and staring blankly at the roof. Quote, "He was like a man in a dream. It was terrible to see him like that. He was broken. He made no objections to coming with me. He didn't say a word. He just got up very, very slowly, and in a break in the shelling, we went out." End quote. July the 1st in our story is already filled with tragedy and countless casualties, but it's just beginning. I hope you'll join me next week as we continue our trip south on the Somme front on July the 1st, 1916.